to the theme, The Place of Secular Music, and we invite our brother Roger Lewis to address us on that theme. Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, and again, my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and my dear young people. Well, this afternoon in our study, you'll remember that we looked at what we call principles of spiritual melody. Those important principles that ought to govern the nature and the content of the sort of music that we have in the context of our worship of the Father. We made the point that we believe there are some trends both in the world and in the brotherhood that are not helpful in that regard, and that we ought to be aware of trends, because trends are terribly important. And we found that the crucial thing, which we believe in fact is a heritage that our hymn book takes up from the very principles of worship in the Old Testament record, is that our hymn book focuses our mind on spiritual thoughts where the music ranks second in priority. And we made the suggestion, and I think it's a very powerful one, is that our hymn book, therefore, is the inheritor of a tradition that actually is rooted in the very concept of biblical worship itself. And that we therefore need to be careful of advances in terms of modern gospel music, that they don't permeate their way into ecclesial life simply because we've been taken by a catchy rhythm or a novel tune, but where the words may be either totally doubtful or perhaps a little on the racy side to go with the tune itself, or perhaps simply merely repetitious, like one I've heard that simply says, in fact I lost count a number of times, I've got something within me, within me, within me, within me, I've got something. It's a very profound piece that elevates the mind and leaves you feeling exhilarated, if somewhat bewildered at the end. And of course the focus again is within me. And this of course is the great focus of secular music in the world, isn't it, in terms of music that has words. And we'll come to this, God willing, in our study tomorrow afternoon, because we're going to try and look more at beneficial things tonight in terms of secular music. But tomorrow we're going to get stuck into that secular music that is harmful. And the great focus of secular pop music is, I am number one. And the great concept of God manifestation is, God is number one, not you. And therein lies two completely different points of view. And therefore, there is a music that is prevalent in the world that runs contrary to the exact notion that God presents both of himself and of our position in relationship to him. I'd like you to come to Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Because here's the beginning of our discussion on secular music. The place of secular music in the life of the believer. And I suppose we should add that, because even secular music isn't going to be considered in isolation. We're talking about music in the context of those who know the truth, those who want to live the truth. And therefore, the principles of the truth will govern even that music that they listen to outside of ecclesial activities. So Ecclesiastes 3 gives us liberty and license to do so, doesn't it? Because it says in Ecclesiastes 3 and verse 4, there is a time to weep and a time to laugh. There is a time to mourn and a time to dance. So there is a time for every season, says Ecclesiastes, and that includes a time of laughter, a time of rejoicing, a time of dancing. All of those things are perfectly permissible in the context of our life in the truth. Nothing wrong with that at all. And in that context there's place for other music above and beyond that which relates to our spiritual activities. But we need to be aware in that context of challenges that are facing us. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to take you through a series of quotations to try and tackle this at least from a biblical point to start with, a biblical point of view to start with, to show that in the Bible it was understood that there was music that could be used for good reasons and music that could be used for more doubtful purposes, and that both sorts of music prevailed even in biblical times. Ecclesiastes says it's perfectly permissible for us to have it, but the Bible goes on to say that there could be good things and bad things for which music might be used. Now, let's have a look at two or three positive reasons. The first of Samuel, chapter 16. You will remember this one. So here's an example of a positive aspect or a positive use of music. 1 Samuel 16 and verse 16. And there it says, "Let our Lord now command thy servants which are before thee to seek out a man who is a cunning player on an harp, and it shall come to pass, when the evil spirit from God is upon thee, that he shall play with his hand, and thou shalt be well." You notice that? David would play and Saul would be well. And so we're told in the 23rd verse of the same chapter, it came to pass, when the evil spirit from God was upon Saul, that David took an harp and played with his hand upon that harp, and Saul was refreshed and was well. So now here's an example in a music that was found, which was for what purpose? Answer, to soothe mental agitation. Here was a music that was useful for soothing mental agitation. And it was obviously beneficial. This was good music, wasn't it, in some way? Whatever it is that David sang, we know that it didn't further agitate Saul. It relaxed him. It refreshed his soul, so that the result is that he felt well as a result of hearing that particular music. What about this one in the 2 Kings chapter 3? Again, you'll remember this one because it's quite famous. In the 2 Kings chapter 3, verse 13, 2 Kings 3, "And Elisha said unto the king of Israel, What have I to do with thee? Get thee to the prophets of thy father and to the prophets of thy mother. And the king of Israel said unto him, Nay, for Yahweh hath called these three kings together to deliver them into the hand of Moab. And Elisha said, As Yahweh of armies liveth before whom I stand, surely were it not that I regard the presence of Jehoshaphat the king of Judah, I would not look toward thee nor see thee. But now, bring me a minstrel. And it came to pass, when the minstrel played, that the hand of Yahweh came upon them, and he said." So here's an interesting reference. What we're told here is that here was music that was used to induce prophecy. This music was such that it invoked within the prophet an attitude of mind that was conducive to the bringing forth of prophetic utterance, which we know was from the hand of God. "But the music itself was beneficial to the prophet," says the record. "Bring me a minstrel. And it came to pass, as the minstrel played, when the minstrel played, that the hand of Yahweh was upon him." So here was a form of music again that was highly beneficial, and that encouraged this prophet to speak forth the words of God. Obviously this was not music that agitated his soul. This was good music. And what about this one? In Luke 15, in the story of the... Now, better be careful what I call it. Take note, in the story of the lost sons, Luke 15, we have the story concerning the return of the younger son. And it says in Luke 15, verse 22, "The father said to his servants, Bring forth the best robe, and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand, and shoes on his feet, and bring hither the fatted calf, and kill it, and let us eat, and be merry. For this my son was dead, and is alive again. He was lost, and is found. And they began to be merry. Now his elder son was in the field, and as he came and drew nigh to the house, he heard music and dancing." So what's the music and dancing of Luke 15 and verse 25? And the answer was, this was the music to celebrate a joyous occasion. In this case, the recovery of a lost son. But it was the celebration of some joyous event. Might have been the birth of a child. Might have been the moment of a marriage. In this case, it was the recovery of a wandering son. But it was the music that celebrated a joyous occasion in the life of these people. Now, it's interesting, actually, you know the word music there? In the Greek, the word music is the word symphonos. Symphonos. From whence, of course, we derive not only the word symphony, but it's also the root word of a phrase found in another place. And the phrase is this. To see if you can pick it up. It's the same word found in Luke there that's also found in this passage. What fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness, and what communion hath light with darkness, and what concord, there's the word, hath Christ with Belial? What symphony is there? What harmony of thoughts? What music can be made between Christ and Belial? They're out of tune, says the apostle. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. No symphony here. Not between Christ and Belial. It's all drawn from the same root word. That's chapter 6, verse 15. So you see, here we've got examples of music that were used in Scripture for good and for beneficial purposes. But there were also occasions, says the Bible, where music could be used in more doubtful ways. What about this one, Ecclesiastes chapter 2? Do you remember the words of Solomon in his weighing up of all the experiences of life that he'd had? We're told this in Ecclesiastes chapter 2. He says this, reading from the 8th verse. So Ecclesiastes 2 verse 8, I gathered me also silver and gold, and the peculiar treasures of kings and of the provinces. I get me men singers and women singers, and the delights of the sons of men, musical instruments, and that of all sorts. So there it is, musical instruments, and that of all sorts, verse 9, so I was great and increased more than were all before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatsoever my eyes desired I kept not from them. Verse 11, and behold, when I looked upon all these things, it was vanity and vexation of spirit. So here's a man that collected music and musical instruments, but when he weighed it up at the end, he said it's only vexation of spirit. This wasn't the best sort of music. Oh, he collected everything that was available. He was an avid collector of everything that was available with Solomon, but it wasn't all good. Some of it led to vexation of spirit, he says. Some of it was counted as emptiness, vanity. So not all music is necessarily beneficial or wise or helpful or good. And what about this one in Amos chapter 6? In Amos chapter 6 we read these words from the third verse. Ye that put far away the evil day and cause the seat of violence to come near, that lie upon beds of ivory and stretch themselves upon their couches and eat the lambs out of the flock and the calves out of the midst of the stall, that chant to the sound of the viol. See what the margin says? That quaver to the sound of the viol, and invent to themselves instruments of music, like David, that drink wine in bowls and anoint themselves with the chief ointments, but they are not grieved for the affliction of Joseph. You see, these instruments weren't David's at all. They were substitutes for David. They were representations of David's instruments, but they weren't the same. They justified making these instruments. They said, well, we're doing what David's done, but they weren't the same. And when they chanted to the songs of these viols, it wasn't the same sort of music at all. And God says, I'll have none of it. Because underneath the heart of these people are not grieved for the affliction of Joseph. And this was not helpful music. They're not told where it came from, but it wasn't music that was beneficial to these particular people. So you see, what we're being told is this. That, and the reason why we're saying this is because, you see, I think sometimes that there are those that say, look, I'm entitled to listen to other music outside of the meeting, and it doesn't really matter what I listen to because it doesn't affect me. If the words aren't good, I won't listen to them. Well, I don't think that's what the Bible says. I think the Bible clearly says there has been good music and bad music down through time. You've got to learn to choose. You've got to learn to differentiate. There is some music that has never ever been helpful, not to the believers. And it isn't good enough to simply say, I can listen to anything without it affecting me. It does, and it will affect you. So we've got to learn to exercise a spirit of discernment, even in that music outside of the truth, that we develop tastes for. And you know, essentially, what it comes down to is this. There are two sorts of music, you see. There's certain music that stirs the most noble emotions. And there is certain music that arouses the baser instincts. They're all secular music. But some of it's good and some of it's bad. And you better work out the difference. Funny thing, you know, the Bible always talks about two ways, doesn't it? The seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. The thinking of the spirit and the thinking of the flesh. Two ways, two women, two mountains, two paths, two trees, two ends. Two sorts of music. Be careful. Be careful how you choose. Now I'm going to take you through an overhead that was developed as part of a series of overheads for our young people in Christchurch. We had a set of standards evenings. Before we did these standards evenings, we had about six evenings with the arranging brethren. We then had five evenings with the parents of all CYC members, and then we then had about five or six nights with the CYC members themselves. So by the time we got to the end of this process, we'd had a few meetings. And we're not saying that this is perfect, because it's very difficult actually to get scriptural quotations about music in detail. And of course the answer is there isn't a whole lot of quotations about what sort of music we ought to listen to or ought not to listen to. But there are principles. There's always principles. And what we've got to get back to is divine principles. That's the only way we can test what we do, isn't it? Is there a divine principle that might have some bearing on this particular question? So here's the principles that we came up with anyway in terms of what we did with our young people. So here it is. We said firstly, music. Talking about the lyrics, first of all. Not corrupt, but pure. Many musical songs use words that focus on violence, permissiveness, drugs, humanism, rebellion, and other evils. This is completely opposed to the divine principle which promotes words and thoughts that are pure, wholesome, and God-honoring. So this is just the lyrics. I'm only talking about the words at the moment, nothing else, just the words of whatever music we might choose to listen to from a secular point of view. Now James 5:13. Anyone know what James 5 says? Can anyone think of those words? We won't turn all of these up, but you might be able to tell me what some of these are. James 5:13. Is any among you afflicted? Let him pray. Is any merry? Let him sing psalms. That's right. Let him sing psalms. Ephesians 4 verses 29 to 32. These are the closing versions of closing verses of Ephesians 4, which tell us about that tender-hearted and kind and pure speech that ought to be amongst those who profess to be saints. And the first of John 2 verses 15 to 17, isn't that about the whole world lying in wickedness and all that is in the world which is not of the Father? The lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. Well, most of us know that there's a lot of music out there that the words are
at the very best suspect, and at the very worst shocking. And that in terms of spiritual mindedness and making a difference between that which is holy and that which is profane, they do not pass the test. So it's absurd, isn't it, for people to say, well, I can listen to it because it doesn't affect me. Oh, yes, it does. Wasn't it Brother John Carter that once said that the mind is insensibly affected by the stream of thought passing through it? I think it was Brother Carter, wasn't it? The mind is insensibly affected by the stream of thought passing through it. And so the whole lesson there was, of course, is that if the stream that passes through our minds is constantly biblical and constantly scriptural, in the end we will become the person of the Bible. We will become the man or the woman of Scripture. But if our mind is constantly listening to, being washed by another stream, we will become a different person. You know, one of the most spooky things about music today, when I was young, which, as I've said before, and I want to keep on stressing, it's not really, you know, such a long time ago, but when I, it always makes you sound old, doesn't it, when a person says, well, I was young. But bear with me, we used to have records at home, those black plastic things. And if we wanted music, we would play music, and we had special permission from Mum and Dad to be able to put one of those on and to play the music that was there. And sometimes you sang folk songs at school. And so the way of getting access to music was actually fairly limited and fairly controlled, wasn't it, in those times? Oh, yes, there was radio, but we didn't have radio in our house. I mean, we had one, but it wasn't allowed to be on. And now we live in a society where, can you think of one moment of time when a person need not be listening to music? And the answer is that music now is such a powerful medium that it's available literally 24 hours a day. It's on video, it's on TV, it's on radio, it's on cassette, it's on CD, it's on Walkman. So wherever you go, it can be with you at all times. Kids study in the library, in the study, in the university, in the school, with the Walkman on and the music pounding away all the time. It's instantly available and absolutely available at all times. So the effect of music is now enormous compared to what it was 50 years ago in terms of shaping the mind. Here's another spooky statistic for you. In fact, two more really spooky statistics. The first one is that in the opinion of experts in America, music is the single greatest factor that shapes character in a young person in America. The single greatest factor that shapes the character of a young person in America, because by the time they finish high school, they have heard more music than they've actually spent hours in education. The average student by that stage has listened to well over 10,000 hours of pop music by that time. It is the single greatest determinant in shaping character. Just think about that. Just listen before you go into the words and what they're all about. You'd be shocked and horrified, believe me, if you knew that that was the great shaper of character. Because it's so widespread now, it's so instantly available. Here's the second great thing to think about, and I really do want you all to think about this tonight, both young and old, because I'm going to come back to the relative position of young and old later on tonight. It's considered that the ages of 15 to 25 are the crucial years for the developing of musical tastes in most of us. And that whatever musical taste we become familiar and comfortable with in the ages 15 to 25 will be the music we respond the most to for the rest of our lives. Ooh, be careful. Just think about that. That whatever we do in that time will become the music that we respond most of all to. I'm not saying people can't buck the system. I'm not saying people can't change their lives. They do, some. But not many. And I think that one of the reasons why we may have a problem, perhaps in the ecclesial world today, with the music of the world beginning to make its inroads, which it's been doing for a long time, but it's still there and it's still increasing, that one of the reasons is because maybe parents have had a problem with this, not just young people. So we'll come to that later on. About what we're going to do about that, what we can do about that. 15 to 25, whatever musical taste you develop in those particular years will become probably the greatest source of music that gives you pleasure that you respond to for the rest of your life. Here's the next thing. So this was the lyrics, you see, not corrupt but pure. Okay, the second thing is the beat. Not offbeat but rhythmic. Many forms of modern music strongly emphasize beat and use irregular timing to build emotion and tension. However, music which encourages, energizes, heals, or soothes tends to follow natural patterns of time. The divine ideal embraces that which is rhythmic and regular. Rhythmic and regular. Rhythmic and regular. You see, the body's got natural patterns, and that music that is the most beneficial to the body will tend to work at least in harmony with those rhythms. But a lot of music, a lot of modern music, is deliberately designed to break those rhythms on purpose, quite knowingly, quite deliberately. And in the breaking of those rhythms, certain music creates a tension, which to start with is quite enjoyable, provided the tension gets resolved at some moment. But a lot of modern music never does resolve the tension. What it does is it winds you up and then keeps you up all the way through. It never lets you down, never lets you off. So the person goes away tense because the rhythm has somehow been disturbed that they're most comfortable with. So there's something about rhythm here that we've got to be careful of in terms of the music that we desire. And the last one is not jarring but harmonious. This is now to do with the sound. First the words, then the beat, and lastly the sound itself, the concordance of sound. Atonal or discordant music is known to harm the body and dull the mind. That which is strident and raucous does not improve but debilitates. The divine principle has always stressed the benefit and happiness which springs from melodious harmony. The very ideas of melody and harmony have such obvious scriptural associations with them, don't they, compared to that which breaks harmony. In the story of the two sons in Luke 15, don't you think that the music of the house was broken? That disharmony occurred because the elder son would not go in, and the harmony of the house was broken by the anger of the elder son. The music became a symbol of the very harmony that existed in the home before he came. So I'm not saying that this is all the answer, but at least this is part of a clue, isn't it? At least it tries to get back to what the principles might be behind what we should be looking for in terms of suitable music. We've got to think about the words, we've got to think about the beat, and we've got to think about the sound. All of these things become important. Well, let's just say this then, that we believe that the most beneficial type of good music, and I'm going to deal with bad music tomorrow, but the most beneficial type of good music, we believe, is of the classical variety. I don't feel ashamed in saying that, by the way, because I remain absolutely convinced that that is the case, but perhaps we should just define our terms a little further. When we talk about classical music actually embraces quite a wide span of time, in case you're really worried that it's going to be too narrow a selection. Classical music really begins in the 1600s with what's called Baroque or Baroque music. Can anyone give me any famous composers for the 1600s, for the Baroque period? No, a little bit later, he's just a tad later. Sorry? Yes, Bach? Bach and Vivaldi are both from the Baroque period, yes? Handel is from that period. Perumal is from that period. So the 1600s was known as the Baroque period, but we would catch that within the embrace of what we would describe loosely as classical music in the best sense of the word. And then the 1700s came what was known as classical music itself. And now we've got Mozart, and we've got Boccherini, and we've got Haydn, and we've got Beethoven. These would be some of the well-known names in that period of the 1700s, what's known as the classical era itself. In fact, we suggest, don't we, that the word classical here means something other than just that one period of time in the 1700s. It's classical music because it's enduring. It's classical music because it has stood the test of time. It's something classical because it unlocked certain things that worked. And it's never changed. So let me give you one or two pieces of information with regard to this sort of music and why it seems to be beneficial. We said that certain music stirs the most noble emotions, and it's been my experience that generally classical music tends to fit this particular bill. Now, some of you may have heard of some of these facts before. If you have, then I'm sorry for retailing them again. If you haven't, well, so much the better, because I hope you'll find at least some of these interesting in terms of the past. Then I'm sorry for retailing them again. If you haven't, well, so much the better, because I hope you'll find at least some of these interesting in terms of the power of classical music. A lady who was on a radio station decided to run an experiment with music, and she decided to grow petunias. And she created two boxes in which petunias would grow. And at the top of each box she put a speaker. And into one box that was planted with petunias, she played classical music, and in the other box she played more or less modern pop music, nothing too outrageous, just the current pop music of the day. And then she watched the plants grow. And what was interesting to see was after 2 weeks, the two boxes, the plants had grown up in both boxes, but a strange thing had happened, is the petunias in the classical music box were all growing towards the speaker. And the plants in the pop music box were all growing away from the speaker. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. These are plants, mind you, not people. I just want you to read me a bit of note. Only petunias. After 4 weeks, the petunias in the classical music box were fat and flourishing. The petunias in the pop music box were stone dead. They died. They actually died. It was believed that the music killed them. Unless you think that be overly dramatic a statement, I'm going to tell you why shortly, because we believe that that is in fact exactly what happened. They did a similar thing with rats. They put rats in two boxes. A big box at each end. And they put a nice little passageway that ran between the two boxes. And they put some rats in this box and some rats in that box. In this box they played rock music. In this box they actually played just one particular composer in this box. Bach. J.S. Bach. You know, it's a funny thing. Because, I mean, these are rats after all. Uneducated, uncivilized, uncultured, relatively barbaric rats. You know what they did? They all migrated to the Bach box. How civilized of them. Remarkable. And so what they did is they changed the music. They played rock music in the Bach box, and they played Bach out of the rock music box. You know what the rats did? They all migrated to the other box. Now what's really interesting about this is, you see, rats don't actually understand classical music any more than petunias do. So you've got to ask yourself this question, why did the rats migrate? And the answer is, not because of any reasoning or logical process, but simply that the physical vibrations of the music are different. And both the rats and the plants sensed the difference in vibrations. So when a person says to you, I can listen to any music I like and it doesn't affect me, don't believe them, because it does. Because all music fundamentally is vibration. Just simple vibration. And plants and animals understand good vibrations and don't like bad vibrations. It wasn't that the rat said, let us appreciate Bach. They just knew instinctively that certain music was good for them and certain music wasn't. There was a chap that did a lot of experimentation on this, and he would pour nutrients on plants to make them grow. But he also decided to play classical music to his favourite plant, which was a purple passion plant. Now, I don't know if you know much about purple passion plants, but this particular purple passion plant normally grows to the grand height of 18 inches. Well, this gentleman not only nursed his purple passion plant, but he played classical music to his plant. And as a result of that, he grew the longest purple passion plant in living history. It was, now remember what the normal height is, 18 inches, he grew a purple passion plant that was 1,400 feet long by playing classical music to it. When it's the Guinness Book of Records, you can look it up, longest purple passion plant in world history. It was all based on classical music, you see. That somehow the music had a beneficial effect upon the plant. Here's another piece of experimentation that was done. Now this one really is spooky. A chap did experimentation on grains and the yield of the grain crop. By playing classical music, he found that he was able to increase the yield of the grain. So that's pretty good. But you know, the really spooky thing about it was that increase in productivity was found to have passed on to the next generation of that grain. Now stop and think about that. So what does that mean? If by playing music to this particular grain, it was able to not only increase productivity, but that grain, when re-sown, yielded the increased level of productivity in the next generation. What had happened was, in some way, the music had affected the genetics of the grain. And it had passed the genetic code on for higher productivity based on the music. And then I found another interesting thing about all this stuff about, I mean, you've heard this before about playing music to plants and cows and stuff, and you think, oh, what a lot of nonsense. Well, it's actually not nonsense. Not nonsense at all. Because it was all based on the power of vibration. Then another thing they found that was rather interesting is, they found, you know, that classical music vibrates at certain frequencies, and they were able to measure the quality and the extent of the vibrations. They measure them in hertz, H-E-R-T or H-E-R-Z. And you know that they found that the vibration cycle that was the most beneficial in terms of plant growth, well, surprise, surprise, related to the sort of cycle found in classical music, but they found that same cycle in another part of nature, in the music of nature somewhere. You know where it was? Sorry? No? It was a creature. Birds. That the same cycle that was found consistently in classical music, the vibration cycle, was also found in bird singing and bird song. And then they did some more tests on that, you see, because we tend to think of the trees and the birds singing in the trees, and we think of that as sort of being a lovely sample of nature, the birds twittering in the trees, but there's no particular relevance to that. Oh yes, there is, because what they found was that the vibrations coming from the bird song promoted the plant life. And that where there were places where there were no birds, the plant life wasn't as good. The foliage wasn't as thick. The vegetation wasn't as strong. And they suddenly found that there was a strange chemistry between the growth of the plants and the birds that sang there. And that what seems to be unrelated was all part of the wisdom of God that was all bound together in cycles that we're only just beginning to discover the power of, and that vibrates at the same frequency as classical music. So that's interesting, isn't it? I've got some information here on accelerated learning techniques. There's an organisation in the States called Super Learning Incorporated, and how they advance learning is they play music. They call it brain food. They actually play music to people to advance their learning. Do you know what they can increase the learning rate by in terms of gifted people? By playing the right music to them. Any thoughts on that? They accelerate the actual learning process for the learning and retention of information by playing music, the right classical music. Now, do you think they can multiply the learning process two times? Double it? By the playing of the right music? Multiply it three times? Four times? Quadruple it, do you think? What do you think that the ratio is on average that they get to by being able to play the right music? In terms of accelerating the learning process. Any thoughts on that? Six, that's a very fleshly number, isn't it? 10 times. They were able to increase the learning process and the learning extent 10 times by the playing of the right music. Which, by the way, is never rock music or never pop music. So they talk about brain food. Here's an idea in terms of brain food. There's a let me just read you an article about ears. Fascinating things, ears. Now, this is a scientist known as Dr. Alfred Tomatis. He's a French ear specialist, and he spent quite a few decades studying ears and the effect of sound upon the ear. And this is what he says. He discovered that there are certain kinds of music which have an abundance of certain frequency ranges which are effective in recharging the central grey nuclei cells in the brain. These cells act like tiny batteries that power your brain waves. You would expect that these tiny batteries must be recharged by your body's internal systems and metabolism, but in fact they found otherwise. He found it wasn't something inside that recharged these brain cells, it was certain frequencies of sound from outside the body that provided the recharge. As sound travels through the inner ear, it whirls around and around through the coils of the snail-shaped cochlea. From there it comes upon a long line of 24,600 cells called the corti cells, which dance a perfectly synchronized dance to each sound. The dance of the corti cells produces energy that splits off, some going to the brain, some going to the vestibular branch of your auditory nerve, and then to the muscles throughout your body. What kind of music would you expect to have the ability to produce the most energizing of the brain, as well as the most release of muscle tension and improvement of bodily functions? And the answer is Baroque and classical music, and especially those pieces rich in strings. And so what they found was that that sort of music, strangely enough, not only goes into the body as sound, but actually energizes the body through the ear. It recharges the brain cells. You ever heard people about talking about music as brain food? Sometimes they talk about water as brain food, don't they? Well, this is music as brain food, and it's not as silly as it sounds, because it's actually an energy recharge of the whole central nervous system and of the brain itself by the right music. And that the same scientist went out to point out those sounds that were the most damaging to the body's process. They were low-frequency sounds like the noise at an airport, construction site, traffic noise, and rock music, which he called brain drain sound. And the effect of that music was actually debilitating on the entire nervous system. There's another article here which talks about musical therapy, and they've done a lot of study to find that not only different sorts of music, but even different sorts of notes have a beneficial effect on different parts of the body. So if you've got a problem with asthma, you should be singing notes or playing music that favours the chord or the key of D, because D is considered to be beneficial to asthma, bronchitis, gout, gallstones, obesity, purification, removal of toxins, lethargy, and apathy in general. And there's a whole series of studies now out on the therapeutic influence of music. And of course, lest we laugh at that, we remember that that's really exactly the 1 Samuel 16, isn't it? That David played and Saul was refreshed. In some way, the music was therapeutic and beneficial. So what we're saying, therefore, is that we believe that classical music is, in fact, the best of other music that we should build as our central core of secular music. If we're going to have other music, then let it start with a foundation of good classical music. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't other forms of music that may be acceptable, but what I do know is there ain't many others. There's not many others. And you'd be better to start with this one, because there is such a tremendous... What we want, you see, is relaxation. This is the music of relaxation that is consistent with the principles of the truth. And yes, there will be personal taste, and yes, there will be personal wisdom, and yes, there will be personal discretion. But at the end of the day, we will choose that music that we find the most beneficial. There's another suggestion that if you're not sure about what music's best for you, it's suggested that you try what's called the music fast. Now, the music fast is where you actually go off all music for a week and you listen to absolutely nothing. You try and hear absolutely no sort of music whatsoever of any shape or description. And then at the end of that period, you sit yourself next to a radio or a stereo or something with the volume up fairly loud, and then you punch the button that will actually launch you into some rock music instantly at a fairly high decibel level, right? And you hit the button. And what he said you'll find, and by the way, this is an article written by a man who played in a rock music band for 8 years, so it's not as if he doesn't know something about the subject. He actually left the rock band he was in because he realised how detrimental it was. He said, if you go on a fast, the music fast for a week, and then you actually play some rock music, you'll feel your whole body stiffen in tension the moment the music starts. And then he says, you switch it off, and you play some classical music, and you'll feel your whole body go, and he says, that'll tell you everything you need to know. Everything you need to know about what music is beneficial and what music is not beneficial. Now, one of my problems with this sort of talk is I don't know how much to say about classical music in terms of what's good and what's bad, because there's a great deal of classical music available and a great deal of personal taste. All I can suggest is that you start building a collection of good classical music. And most classical music will be acceptable and beneficial. There's a few pieces of classical music that are a bit odd, but by and large, it's actually quite good. You see, to me it's a bit like this. Have you ever seen a child's painting of a person or a face? It's got a paintbrush that's run around in a circle. It's got a couple of dabs for eyes. Got a little wee bit for a mouth, it's got a splodge for a nose. And we encourage little children, don't we, to paint and to experiment. We say, well, that's really good, that looks just like Mummy. That's Daddy speaking. And then you see the picture of an old woman by a master painter like Rembrandt. And you know there's just no comparison. That the master painter has somehow able to bring together such skill, such ability, that it's almost as if you could reach out and touch the skin, and that if you did, the painting would be warm from the blood that you could feel on the glow of the cheek, and the sparkle of the eye. And you feel that you could touch the hair because the painting is so incredibly real, and you suddenly realise there's no comparison to the master work. And some feeble attempt of a child to try and render the portrait of a person on paper. Well, it's a bit like that with music. You see, that once you've had a taste for the real stuff, and you see, I call classical music the real stuff only because, you see, you start to understand a bit about harmony, and about instruments, and about how they cooperate together, about how real harmony is built. And once you've got a taste for that, and you understand that, you realise that unfortunately much else, if I can put it in the most respectful of terms, much else in modern music is actually just trash. That's all it really is. There's nothing to commend itself in terms of the spirit of excellence. And you see, one thing that we ought to desire in the truth is excellence in every single thing we do, in every field of endeavour. Why not excellence in music as well? Well, so it ought to be. So, we have a bit of a problem. I think, with the fact that sometimes not everyone listens to classical music, and perhaps particularly we've got a generation in the world today. I read an article on pop music that says that classical music is dead amongst young people. So why is classical music dead amongst young people? And I think that the answer is that if it is dead, it's because mum and dad maybe didn't listen to classical music either. Maybe mum and dad came up on a diet of pop music, which 30 or 40 years ago wasn't so bad. It was only the Beatles then. It was much better. Or was it? Maybe all the things that are being promoted in modern pop music today were being promoted 30 or 40 years ago, just not as bad, just not as obvious, just not as loud, just not as raucous, but perhaps were all there, all the values of humanism. I think that the best way to actually develop a taste for good music is to start in the home. And you see, we can exhort young people, as by the way, I hope that we do, to say, look, you've got to get a taste for the right music, you've got to get a taste for classical music right now, while you've got time, before you turn 25. It's urgent. But the best way to give young people a taste for that sort of music is that that's what comes into your home. And to do that, mum and dad have to be really convinced of the wisdom and the rightness of this principle. So let me tell you what I did in my home, and it's simply this. When each of my children get to the tender age of 13, that marvellous age at which teenage life begins, those years that we all look forward to with keen anticipation as parents, because it's the time when a child unfolds, isn't it, in terms of their thinking and their understanding on so many different things. So when each of my children get to 13, provided they're in a separate bedroom, they qualify because of the beneficence and kindness of their father for their own CD player in their room. They have their own one. Only had to do it so far twice, but the third one coming up, unfortunately, very, very shortly. But here's the rule. No CDs appear in my home at all, apart from what Father has bought. And Father, for some strange reason, only seems to ever buy classical CDs. So my children have grown up with Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto, and Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto, and Max Brooks' Cole Needry for the cello. They've grown up to understand that there was nothing else in the house because Papa bought all the CDs. And yet the funny thing about it is that they actually love that music. They've grown up to know it and to love it because there was nothing else. And they don't like other music now because they haven't got a taste for it. And you know what? They're not even 25 yet. So there's time yet, you see, but it's so crucial that it begins in the home. And I think that that's the easiest route for any parent to have, that if you make that the rule of your home, then your young people will grow up with that taste, and you won't struggle with terrible problems later on, which I know that some parents have done. But you've got to be convinced of the importance of it. And so, may I remind you of what we've said already tonight, don't ever imagine that young people can be left to listen to whatever music they want and that it won't affect them, because it will. It will affect them both in terms of the physical impact of the music, and it will certainly affect them in terms of the lyrics. So what about the lyrics of most modern music? Well, remember what we read tonight in the reading. Let's just turn to this, Philippians chapter 4. It's simple really, isn't it? And both simple and obvious. But this is the real test. So any piece of music has got to pass muster with Philippians 4 verse 8. Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue and if there be any praise, think on these things. things. So the Bible says, well, here it is. Here's the measurement for music and for everything else, you know, for that means, but we can certainly use it as a measure for music. Does it pass the test of Philippians 4 verse 8? Then we may consider having it in the house. Does it not pass the test of Philippians 4 verse 8? Then it will not be in this house. This house is a sanctuary for the truth. And everything that goes on with this house and in this house ought to be consistent with divine principles, even including the music that permeates through this house. My house is a very strange place, actually, because if you came into my place, you'll find that there will be, probably if I'm at the height of studying something, whenever I get to the most intense moment in the study, I've got to play Rachmaninoff's third piano concerto. Absolutely crucial at the moment of cracking something in terms of my study. So that's one of my favourite bits. So if you come into my house at the time that I'm cracking something, inverted commas, you'll hear Rachmaninoff's third piano concerto issuing out of the door of my study. You may hear something else issuing out of the door of my son's room. You'll hear something else issuing out of the door of my daughter's room. And you'll hear a cello or a flute or a piano being played in yet another room. And there's actually probably a cacophony of sound coming out of the house. But it's a classical cacophony. And there's wonderful enjoyment in that. And I'm completely content in the knowledge that my children play music in their rooms because I know exactly what they're playing because I bought it. And I've never had any trouble with that. I've never had children worried about that because they developed a taste from the earliest age, but they haven't wanted anything else. It's like the Rembrandt painting. When you've seen the masters, you don't want the children's pictures any longer. Well, brothers and sisters, I see that our time has probably gone. As I say, I'm not going to go into classical music in detail, although I think, Brother Chairman, that tomorrow afternoon we have provided opportunity for a question session after the study so that there's a forum for interchange. So if anyone wants to raise things about particular pieces of music that are their favourites or that they think are good or whatever, then I think tomorrow afternoon is a good opportunity to do that and to raise those. If there's something you'd like to share with the group as a whole in terms of music that you think is particularly beneficial, then let's do that tomorrow afternoon. Everything we do, brothers and sisters, in the truth, even in our moments of relaxation, ought to be consistent with divine principles and consistent with the spirit of those whom God hath called to glory and to virtue.